ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I worked out that if I was to stay in my role down south, it would have taken me 25 years to pay off my hex debt, whereas it's only going to take me 5.5 years to pay it off in the role that I'm in.
Mining can be a tough gig, especially the fly-in, fly-out lifestyle. But as the cost of living bites and makes it more difficult to get ahead financially, many young people are heading to the mines for higher paid work. That story soon. And 50 years ago, students would be punished for taking this class. Now they're helping to bring this Indigenous language back.
If we spread it out and have non-Indigenous people speaking our language as well, there's a greater chance that we won't lose it, and we don't want to lose it.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide. But firstly, mineral sands are used to make everything from electric cars and smartphones to sunscreen. As Australia enters what Trade Minister Don Farrell is calling a golden age in critical minerals development, mining companies are eyeing vast stretches of farmland in Victoria and New South Wales for mineral sand mines. But farmers are concerned about the loss of agricultural land and the future health of areas earmarked for mining. One proposed mineral sands mine has been accused by farmers of using questionable tactics to secure land and putting their crops and land at risk. Mining company VHM says it has discovered one of the world's largest rare earth deposits in the small farming town of Lalbert in northern Victoria. It's proposing to mine 1,500 hectares of agricultural land and build a rare earths processing plant, which it says could inject hundreds of millions of dollars into the state's economy. That proposal is now the subject of an inquiry by the Victorian government. Mildura reporter Elsie Kennedy has this story.
Don Lethbridge will turn 86 this year, and he's still growing crops in northern Victoria with his son, Roby. He says he was recovering in hospital from multiple fractures to his hip, leg and arm from a farming accident in 2017 when he was visited twice by staff from mining company VHM, who asked him to sign paperwork giving them access to his land.
They had a bit of paper in about a normal size book wanting me to sign this to give them permission to go in and dig holes, and I would not have the bar of it.
Roby Lethbridge says asking his father to sign legal documents when he was seriously injured and in hospital was a questionable tactic by the mining company.
I just thought it was a bit morally sort of wrong.
VHM's consultation process with the Lalbert community, as well as the environmental impact of its proposed Goshen project, is the subject of an inquiry this month by a committee appointed by the Victorian government. The Lethbridges are giving evidence at the inquiry against the mining proposal, alongside their neighbours Nola and Gordon Bennett. The Bennett family has been farming in northern Victoria for 130 years, but Nola Bennett says they may not be able to continue if VHM's proposed mine is approved just 500 metres from their home.
It's been very stressful. It's on your mind, day and night.
The rare earth elements VHM wants to harvest are used in the powerful magnets needed for many new technologies, like electric vehicles and wind turbines. But they're also found together with the radioactive elements uranium and thorium. That's a concern for the Bennetts, who harvest rainwater from their rooftops and are worried about the health impacts of dust from the mine.
We have rainwater tanks as our water supply for everything, for drinking, eating, cooking, washing, and all of our rainwater is harvested from the roofs that are going to be covered in radioactive dust.
A spokesperson for VHM said the company was unable to comment while an inquiry into its proposal was ongoing. Mining radiation expert Peter James Hondros, who was hired by VHM to provide evidence to the hearing, told the panel the maximum dose of radioactivity to members of the public from the mine would be well below the dose limit. The project is just one of several mineral sand mines slated for Victoria in coming years. Six other potential mines are in planning and exploration stages, and a mineral sand mine at Donald has already received approval. University of Sydney Professor of Global Governance Susan Park says these minerals are desperately needed as Australia transitions to renewable energy and reduces its reliance on China.
Demand for critical minerals, demand for renewable energy, it's not going away anytime soon. It's really urgent that we transition. And so to be able to make use of the materials that we already have and to value add in terms of get a greater gain for the Australian economy is kind of a natural no-brainer.
Australia could be a major player in critical minerals, with the Minerals Council suggesting Australia's mineral sand deposits could supply a third of the world's titanium, more than two-thirds of its zircon, and a small but valuable quantity of rare earths. The federal government is keen to make the most of the valuable resource and is offering $6 billion in support for companies to mine and process critical minerals.
And this is the one thing that we see in the United States and the European Union, is that you can provide government support to help spark investment in manufacturing of and processing of critical minerals.
Peter and Leanne Poehler live next door to the Bennetts. They say if approved, the mines could affect some of Victoria's most reliable and productive cropping land.
If it was just the money, well, we'd probably find something else to do. But we feel we're doing something that's important, growing food. We really, really do feel that.
But not everyone is against the proposal. For a small town like Kerang, the prospect of bringing hundreds of jobs to the region is a rare and exciting one.
We really need a labour-intensive type work to come to this region. Goshen's talking, 500 jobs the first couple of years and 300 for the next 30 to 40 years, just for that one project.
That's Kerang Exchange Hotel manager Rob Sutterby. He says the extra customers would be a big help for his business.
It's bringing that many people in, well-employed, affluent sort of jobs, technical jobs, into the country is a huge bonus for the region.
The committee is due to deliver its report on the mine to the Victorian government in June.
That report by Mildura reporter Elsie Kennedy. And staying in the mining sector, as the cost of living bites, many young people are heading to the mines for higher paid work. Mining is an industry that comes with many challenges, long days, fly-in, fly-out work, and for women, it can still be a tough place to work. But the upside, well, people that work in mining earn a lot more money, so it's no surprise that in the midst of a cost of living crisis, people might be looking to this work as an option. And one recruiter says she's seen a big increase in young people and women heading to the mines. Rockhampton reporter Scout Wallen takes a look into why some younger Aussies are choosing to work in the mining industry.
I was working in fertilisers where I built connections down in Victoria. One of those connections then moved up into the mining industry and contacted me and offered me a role working with them.
It might not be everyone's cup of tea, but for 27-year-old Sienna Mallon, taking up this offer was a no-brainer. And so 2 years ago, she swapped her chilly home in Victoria for the scorching heat of central Queensland.
And one day it was like 1st of October and I woke up and it was like 40 degrees or something. And I remember being like, as a Victorian, this is outrageous.
Now she's a superintendent and loving it. And she's built a huge TikTok following, sharing videos of her mining life with 125,000 followers.
Made this video while I was making my coffee saying that mining industry is not for the faint of heart when you've got to wear long sleeves and long pants to go to work at 40 degrees on the 1st of October. And then I started getting heaps of questions like in that, like, how did you get in? What do you do? So then I just kept answering those questions.
I live in a small mining town. I'm given this house as part of the contract that I work for, and the house is owned by the company that I work for.
You're getting a fit check. We've got hard yakka, short sleeve work shirt.
I'm going to say it as if I've never used a radio before, and let's see what type of response I get from someone on the other end. Good morning. Can I please get a radio check?
Okay.
Thank you. Is this guy? That is not how I expected it to go.
The Bowen Basin in central Queensland is one of the largest coal reserves in the country. It's where Crystal Liu is also starting her career.
I never knew I wanted to go into mining in the beginning. I did my first internship and I loved it.
Crystal's now working as a graduate engineer in a coal mine here.
And I really liked the engineering side of it. It was very interesting in terms of the chemical engineering aspect. I hop on the bus at 4:40 and I get here at 5 and we leave at 5:30 on the dot. But I honestly don't feel the 12 and a half hour days. It honestly goes by so quickly. And I feel like being on site and going out in the field, there's so much to do on a day-to-day basis.
Sienna and Crystal are part of a growing cohort of younger Aussie women heading out to work in the mines. Kirsty Sewell runs Industry Resumes Australia, a company which helps people find jobs in the resources and mining sector. She reckons she's seen a huge increase in younger people jumping into the field.
I've been doing this for the past 10 years. And predominantly, it used to just be middle-aged men that would be needing resumes for FIFO roles. But lately, I'm seeing a lot more of my clients are female and also younger, so more within the 18 to 25-year-old age bracket.
According to federal government data, the average earnings of a mining sector worker is $2,403 a week, higher than the average of $1,300.
So the one thing that about earning the money that we earn as well is you, like, the financial stress goes away. So what I worry about now is, have I saved enough money, not how can I afford to live.
The gig has helped Sienna cut down her student debt.
I worked out that if I was to stay in my role down south, it would have taken me 25 years to pay off my hex debt, whereas it's only going to take me 5.5 years to pay it off in the role that I'm in.
For Crystal, the FIFA roster is also part of the appeal.
The flexibility of the lifestyle really surprised me. Transitioning over as a grad and then becoming FIFO, I like love my roster routine, have a long weekend every single weekend, get all my work done in like short span of 4 days.
According to Women in Mining and Resources Queensland, which is linked to the mining industry's lobby group, Queensland has the highest number of younger women in mining, with 38% of women in Queensland mining younger than 34.
Being a woman, I've never felt, you know, like I wouldn't have the same opportunity as anyone else here.
But it isn't all pots of gold or coal in this instance under the rainbow.
Some of the challenges would be obviously working in a predominantly male environment.
It is still a very challenging environment for young women to manage their way through. So I don't agree that it shouldn't be for the faint of heart, but at this current point in time it is.
Scout Wallen reporting there on young people entering the mining industry.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company. If you were to learn a language, what would you choose? Japanese, French, German, Spanish? What about an Indigenous Australian language? Once banned from being taught in schools and spoken in playgrounds, many Indigenous languages in Australia were almost lost. However, non-Indigenous Australians are eagerly taking up native tongues and helping resurrect these languages and cultures. James Tugwell has this story.
Have a look at it in your dictionary. Find Dumbummel. So Dumbummel means sea. And it's a verb.
I'm sitting in the back of a TAFE classroom on the New South Wales far south coast. Not that long ago, what we're doing here in this class would be almost illegal.
That's how you would write it. Dumbummel lager means I saw.
Patricia actually, one lesson, talked to us about totems and the meaning they have to Aboriginal people and what her totems were. And I thought that was really cool. I didn't realise that there was a totem for this area for all people, which is the black duck.
We're learning the Dooriga language, traditionally spoken by Yuin people along parts of the New South Wales south coast.
And that is, here's the earth, here's the sky, here is the land, here am I. Hand to hand, shoulder to shoulder, we are on Brinjeryuwin land.
As late as the 1970s, speaking and teaching Indigenous languages was banned in Australia. Dooriga was one of dozens of languages that were almost lost forever. Yuin woman Trish Ellis, who teaches the class, helped revive the language through the creation of the Dooriga Dictionary, which contains more than 730 words.
Nobody can speak Dooriga fluently, because Aboriginal people around here were denied language, culture, land, everything.
Prior to colonisation by Britain, Australia had 250 distinct languages with more than 600 dialects. However, the Australian government banned Aboriginal languages in pursuit of assimilation. As a result, languages were disappearing in Australia at a faster rate than anywhere else in the world, according to a report by researchers at Oxford University in 2000. But since the revival of Dooriga in the last few years, Trish has seen more and more young Yuin people learning their own language, many for the first time.
Being a part of the revival of our language actually helps them to figure out who they are and how they want to be involved in the revival of anything Aboriginal. So it gives me great pride to be able to pass on the language and the knowledge, but it also gives me great pride when I see that the young people have embraced it and develop a pride as well.
But what's particularly unique about this classroom is nearly all the students are non-Indigenous. Trish opened the Dooriga class to non-Indigenous students last year. She was initially hesitant to see the language shared outside the Yuin people.
When we first started, the committee said, let's teach our own mob first, because none of us want to be taught by a non-Aboriginal person. We want to be taught by our own mob. And so anyone who does the right thing with language will make sure that the Aboriginal community is involved first and foremost.
Now, she says the best way to keep culture alive is to share it.
And if we just confine the Dooraga language to Aboriginal people, there's a very real chance that we could lose it again. If we spread it out and have non-Indigenous people speaking our language as well, there's a greater chance that we won't lose it, and we don't want to lose it. We've already lost it. Well, we didn't lose it. We were denied it, and we don't want to lose it.
She's been blown away with the uptake and interest. 23-year-old Molly Carter started learning Dooraga a few weeks ago.
I want to work down here, and like this is where the language is, and it'll be a great thing to have someone that can teach children the local language. And I think it's important that children are taught the local language and that it's carried on for future generations. It's a way of respecting the history, and what's occurred is by learning the language and learning a part of that culture. I think language is a starting point for learning the rest of the culture.
Molly grew up in Maruya on the south coast, and she wants the next generation of students to grow up knowing more about Australia's Indigenous history than she ever did.
My learning at high school was shocking of Indigenous culture. Never really felt like I knew that much except for what my parents had taught me about it. For me, it's not even just the language that you're learning. It's the cultural side of it that you're learning as you're learning the language.
Education support officer and Yuin woman Gail Nolan was nervous at first to share language with non-Indigenous people. She studied under Trish and now helps out teaching others, and says teaching non-Indigenous students is the only way to maintain culture.
We haven't had language for so long, like through so many generations, and I was really nervous because I thought, you know, like it's... you don't want it taken out of the hands of Aboriginal people again. And, you know, like you're learning the dialect of what ancestors used to speak before they weren't allowed to speak. So, yeah, I've definitely got a sense of pride to be able to speak the language that has not been heard for a long time. You know, like it's not just about the language, it's about culture.
When Trish looks at a classroom full of non-Indigenous and Indigenous students sitting side by side and poring over the Dooraga dictionary or practicing different phrases, syntax and grammar, she couldn't be more proud. She knows her language and her culture are safe for the future.
And you can't really teach culture without language. They go hand in hand. And the more people who speak our language, the less chance we've got of losing it a second time.
TAFE language teacher Trish Ellis, ending that report by James Tugwell. In an age of urbanisation and big diesel motors, a career path that perhaps flies under the average Australian's radar is that of an outback horse trainer. On cattle stations across Australia's north, Hamish Lamond breaks and trains horses, but he often finds the humans walk away with the bigger lesson. Alice Marshall saddled up with him to find out more.
Motorbikes and helicopters are pretty common sights on outback cattle stations. But Hamish Lamond is keen on making sure that horses stay in the mustering mix too.
I grew up east of Perth in a little town called York, and we'd always had horses around as kids, and I've always just loved being around horses and loved being able to get on a horse and go and explore a bit of bush behind home. So I suppose that's where the love for horses came. Yeah, I'd always loved horses, and then I suppose through high school I stopped riding as much, and then I actually, when I left school, I had photography as my first preference to go to uni, but my parents said it would probably be a good idea to take a gap year, and I ended up going to Ruby Plains Station out of Halls Creek, and I can remember the day, I can even remember where we were, and we were just sitting, I was sitting on a horse blocking up some cattle, and I was like, this is pretty cool, I'm getting paid to sit on a horse and do what I love.
These days, Hamish is a horse breaker and trainer, and a bit of a human trainer too.
Yeah, this time of the year I'll spend the majority of my time going from station to station, especially before they start getting into mustering, and just help put a bit of a foundation for the year around how they're going to handle and work their horses. I genuinely just love horses and love being on their back and love being able to work and influence staff and hopefully help instill some great values in the industry and leave each place in a little bit better place if it's not the people, the horses or the cattle, which is, yeah, pretty cool. there's definitely different characteristics and traits in all different horses, which keeps me sort of adapting and changing what I do with horses. And they'll all sort of take different things at a different pace. So all horses are different in a sense, but I think it all does come back to one general idea of how they operate. And with how I work them, I'm always learning new things and I'm always changing, which is pretty cool. I'm definitely not stuck in a way and say that this suits every single horse that I come across. So I'm lucky enough to have some great people in my life that I call mentors, and if I come across a bit of a tricky horse, I'll speak to them and try things a bit of a different way. Probably two values that I really hold in a high regard is compassion and empathy, and I feel working with horses to get the best out of them, that has to be high up in your list. So I just try and think of everything from the horse's perspective, relate everything I do back to how horses used to live and what makes horses tick.
Hamish Lamond there, ending that story by Alice Marshall. And finally, here in Australia Wide, some of the fastest shearers from Wales have put their skills to the test against gun shearers from Australia over the weekend. In a speed shear, competitors have to shear just one sheep as quickly and as cleanly as possible, with the fastest on the night getting the wool off in less than 22 seconds. It's a growing sport in the UK, and a team from Wales travelled to Wagga Wagga to take part in a competition. But Welsh shearers Gethin Lewis and Ian Jones told Emily Doak they got in some practice in an Aussie shearing shed first.
Wagga, I've come to Wales last 2 years representing their team and I guess Australia. So we've had the invite to come back over for an away test match back in Wagga. So we thought we'd better get a bit of practice in, having none of us been to Australia before. So we're lucky enough to have a couple of stands with Muddy Shearing, based from Dubbo. But yeah, we've been shearing a few merinos, so experiencing a bit of the Aussie shearing culture that way. We've had a bit of banter, but nothing too serious, so we've got on real well. A bit of fun.
Now tell me a little bit about the type of sheep that you have back home in Wales that you work with. How are they different to the merinos of Australia?
Start off, there's no wrinkles. That's a big bonus. We've found that hard to get used to. You don't really have to think much by shearing the cheaper UK, but with these merinos, your left hand has to be working all the time and has to keep a flat comb, not ride out like we've been doing in the shed. But the sheep are generally more open, not much belly wool, no top knots, nothing. They're pretty fast shearing, and coming over here and shearing 35 runs breaks your heart a bit, but it's okay.
And so the breeds of these sheep, what are they?
Bush mules. The actual Welsh breed itself, they're more like smaller mountain type sheep. But yeah, there's Cheviots, there's a few Romneys, but there's so many breeds in Britain. You could be shearing 5 different breeds a day and 10 different breeds in a week.
A recently sized flock, 1,000 sheep, you'd be doing good. Usually around the 500-600 mark, but then a lot of farmers now, 200, 300, so a lot of setups in a day, it'd be 3-4 setups. If you've got 3 decent shearers, so it's a lot of moving about and shearing in the sun, in the paddock. Yeah, it's total difference to the sheds out here.
You'd be a lot more mobile, smaller flocks to shear only, and as you say, setting up and shearing in the paddocks rather than a shed.
Yeah, we've all got mobile trailers and they're getting better now that these race trailers come over from Ireland. It makes our job much easier. The hard thing is when the weather raining, we haven't got much cover.
Wouldn't rain much there though, would it?
Yeah, well, we've had a good 4 or 5 months rain now, so
hopefully we'll be right for a bit.
Yeah.
So how do you think you're going to go here in Australia today against the Wagga team?
I think we've got a pretty good chance. We'll give it our best. We've had a lot of knowledge off these local people, what combs to use, and hopefully we'll pull off and have a win, yeah.
We'll do our best, make Wales proud, and take a win home.
And they did come away with the win. That's Gethin Lewis and Ian Jones, who were part of the Welsh shearing team, which defeated the Australian speed shear team from Wagga Wagga over the weekend. And that is Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Alex Hyman. Jonathan Kendall will be in the presenter's chair tomorrow. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.